We ready?
Yeah, the record is saved.
Today is March 22nd. Call the House Judiciary together at 10 minutes after the hour of 1. We have two bills in front of us today, HB 34, which we've heard once before, and then I'll explain later, but it's the common call, the criminal, because the crime law that HB 102, that we had before. We're going to hear that. We have with us today Representative Grunberg, Representative Foster, Representative Ledoux, Representative Lynn, and myself, Chair Representative Keller, Representative Millett, and Representative Pruitt are excused, so they will not be here today. I just want just a little bit of housekeeping. I want to say on HB 102, we're going to be asking the Department of Law to give us a briefing on what's changed over on the Senate side and figure out where we're at. I'd really like to get in a position where we can at least consider action on the bill on Monday, if possible. So try to get your questions out, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But, I mean, we want to give that our best shot if we can. I know there will be some amendments probably pending that I hear about on Monday. With that, we're going to start with HB 34 and ask the sponsor to come up and identify herself and refresh our memories a little bit. It's been about 30 days, and we've got several online to testify on HB 34, and we have several in the room. So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tammy Wilson, and I represent District 2. And I'll just do a little overview, and then I want to point out a few things that are on the fiscal note that I just find very interesting. What this does is that it, before we accept any federal funding, we are asking, first of all, that the federal government give us an economic impact on what that money would mean, whether or not it starts a program, and whether or not that program has to keep going many years down the line, and then, if so, who's responsible for paying that. If they will not respond, because it's our understanding a lot of times the federal government doesn't respond to the state, is that we have asked the state to do that, and not just on a state level, because one thing I think that we really miss here on this level is we don't look what we do and how that impacts the communities and businesses as well. And so with that, I received an indeterminate fiscal note, and I just wanted to bring up a couple of things so that I do have a couple of people in the room who will be responding to it. It's on page 2 if you have the fiscal note in front of you, about halfway down. It really kind of has it in a nutshell what the objection is by the state. And for me personally, Mr. Chair, I am really surprised we don't currently do it. It's at least on the state level that we know the impact the federal funding has done. We all have been talking about Obamacare and how, you know, that may negatively impact us, and we shouldn't just think it does. We should really know before we start these types of programs. No Child Left Behind was another one in which we were pulled into by the federal government, which has cost not just the state a lot of money, but has also cost our communities a lot of money trying to come up with more highly qualified teachers versus you used to have teachers who were able to teach two or three subjects in your smaller schools. Now they're required to have more teachers in there, and it doesn't necessarily make the system better. And so I just kind of wanted to point out that it one portion of this, it says, if a federal law has a significant impact, then staff and very likely economic consultants may need to be hired to determine the impact on the state and all the state's communities and industries. And then in the next paragraph it says, there are just under 250 communities in Alaska. Assessing the economic impact to these communities is not a function that agencies are typically staffed to perform. State employees implement and execute federal and state programs and cooperative agreements. They are not required to assess the economic impacts to communities and industry. Individual communities are responsible for providing this information to the legislature directly if they choose to do so. Well, just with that statement, how do they know? So when we take federal funding on this level, how do our communities know? You know, and hopefully the administration will be able to answer that. Do we contact them? Do we give them notice? Do we ask them how this will impact them? So it's my understanding that we don't have any kind of obligation to them. For a department to provide this information would be a tremendous undertaking and would require additional staff and consultants depending upon the requirements of the law, regulation, or presidential executive order. This is just me as Representative District 2. We should have already been doing this. And I'm really appalled that we're not. And I'm just as curious as you are to hear why we're not doing it and why we think that the state shouldn't be responsible. Will it cost a lot of money? You know, we should already know that. We should already be performing that every day before we take the funding, especially with this group. We, you know, most of us in the room, have been making shots lately back at the federal government saying we are tired of unfunded mandates. So I guess the question pointing at me as being a representative is, are we doing the same thing on the state level? Are we taking funding and then taking the mandates and putting them down on our communities and expecting them to figure out how to fund them? And if we are, we need to make sure we stop doing that. And it's not because I don't think that I think all federal funding is bad. That is absolutely not my point. My point is that if there's a mandate and they have to stick a carrot out in front of you in the, you know, in money being that carrot, don't we have to ask ourselves whether or not we would do it anyway? And I have a feeling the answer would be no more than it would be yes. Why would they have to give us money if it was such a good idea? But with that, we do have some people in the room and I believe online that might be able to answer our questions on this. And if you have any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Does anyone have any clarification questions for the sponsor? Okay, we'll go right directly to, I guess we have here Office Management and Budget, and we have the Department of Law here, Stacy. Well, I don't know who wants to start, but do you have an order? Have you coordinated? If not, Stacy, come on up and
I'll go first.
Identify yourself for the record and answer, explain your perspective, and maybe answer some of the sponsors' questions.
Sure. For the record, my name is Stacy Crayley. I'm a Chief Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. And let me preface my comments by stating we're not here to voice either support or opposition to the legislation, but rather to put on the record some concerns that the administration has about how this legislation may potentially impact the executive branch going forward. And those concerns are threefold, and hopefully as I answer or I put the position on the record, that may answer some of the questions that the sponsor has raised or may raise other questions. Specifically, we have three kind of major concerns with the bill as it's drafted. And the first one would be the cost. In the context of both cost related to outlay of expenses for the departments to evaluate these executive orders or legislative actions on the federal level or presidential actions, regulations, or otherwise, that we would have to evaluate all of those, and there would be a significant cost outlay to do that, which would require specific expertise on the part of individuals in different departments of the in the administration to evaluate the economic impact, not just at the state level, but this legislation purports to require an economic impact at the state level, the local level, and impact on private industry. So the cost isn't so much evaluating the legislation as a going concern, but also being able to find, so that leads to our second concern, which is identifying the information that would be needed to make that qualitative and quantitative analysis and make it useful to the state of Alaska. Gathering the data points or the information from local government and or from private industry is not something we have access to and or would be familiar with or be able to require individuals to provide information to us. So it creates a little bit of a potential catch-22 where we're having to evaluate and create an economic impact on these actions based upon state, local, and private industry concerns. And aside from some of the state information that we would have access to, we don't have access to the local information, nor do we have access to the private information, nor do we have any way to mandate that information be gathered for us. The third concern that the administration has is that as the bill is drafted, it requires a delay in evaluating, or it creates a delay because you have to evaluate and create this economic impact analysis. And so there are circumstances where that delay could create serious concerns, both in terms of the receipt of federal money and or the outlay of money that is coming into the state or being matched by the state in order to administer some of these programs. And we may lose out on federal funding. We may lose out on building seasons. We may lose out on other circumstances that would have an adverse impact, not just on state function, but local function and the private business, which the sponsor is trying to address. So those are the three major concerns that the administration has. We, again, are willing and able and would like to continue to work on these issues. We understand the intent of the legislation, and we're interested in working with the committee or the sponsor to achieve these goals. But as drafted, those are the three major concerns that we have at this time.
Representative Liu?
You know, I'd like to ask both you and, I guess, the bill sponsor, where it says on line 14, page 1, line 14 of the bill, the economic effect of the federal law, et cetera, will have on each community.
Wait, you're on page 1 or 2?
I'm on page 1.
Page 1, line 14?
13 and 14.
13 and 14? Yep.
Oh, wait a second.
Wrong version.
Sure.
Okay, that's a good point to clarify here. Let's go to make sure you have version C in front of you. It's a blank CS. And I don't remember if we made that. I think we did make it the working copy. Thank you, Susan.
That was my question, too, which version we were going on.
Great.
So,
no need to answer my question.
Okay. I want to confirm. You're saying that the department law has no comprehensive review, then, of federal mandates, executive orders, et cetera, as far as how they affect us fiscally in the state?
Through the chair, there are reviews conducted every day based upon federal legislation, regulations, and or executive orders that are issued both by the Department of Law and or by the executive branch agencies, the different departments that are affected by those decisions. There is, as I understand it, those are done, I would, and the best way to explain it would to identify it was basically on an ad hoc basis. So as an example, one of the examples that the sponsor identified was Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act. When that came out, there was enormous effort on the part of my office, the attorneys in my section, and others in the Department of Law, as well as the Department of Health and Social Services, to evaluate the impact of that federal legislation going forward, both assuming it would go forward, and then once it was affirmed by the Supreme Court, then we, you know, kicked it into high gear. But there was a number of efforts on the part of my office and the department to evaluate the fiscal impact on how, say, the Medicaid expansion may or may not impact the state of Alaska. So it does happen. There aren't people that are dedicated to that effort, and the amount of information that is generated by the federal government is overwhelming, as one can imagine, as I'm sure you're all very well aware of. So we don't have dedicated positions for those issues, but when issues or legislation or regulations are promulgated, we keep up on them through listservs and through other circumstances, read the CFRs, the federal regulations, or the Federal Register, and keep on top of it on a case-by-case basis. But there is nobody dedicated to that position or to those efforts in the Department of Law, or from my perspective, and again, I know the Department of Health and Social Services. I don't know what other departments have, but we do it on a case-by-case basis, and as things come out, we do evaluate them, and we do have information, but it's not dedicated positions, which would be required to review everything that came out of the federal government.
I think your answer was no, we don't do it, and we try, and it may be impossible. And with Obamacare is a good maybe an extreme example, but you know what I've noted on that is that the financial projections, which are really significantly out there right now, you know, because of the Obamacare expansion issue, they're wildly variance. I mean, it is a huge, I mean, it's just massive, you know, so it'd be a very difficult task. But so Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Crayley, a lot of times when a legislature acts, it provides a very broadly worded statute with a direction to the affected agency or agencies to implement it through regulation. I can't tell from this whether this envisions you being the state, having to assess the effect when the law itself is enacted, and you can't tell what the regulations are going to say, or whether you'd be able to wait until the regulations themselves come out. How do you read that as a lawyer?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, that I agree with that concern, and that was kind of my timing point that I made earlier in my presentation. Not in addition to the timing point that I talked about in terms of delays and having to create this economic impact analysis to evaluate how this would affect going forward, but we do have issues. Legislative enactments are created at the federal level. The federal regulatory process is a rather, well, it's not anything like our regulatory process, and very long and laborious, and so the impact from the legislative to the regulatory pronouncements that come out of the federal provisions. I mean, they're still enacting provisions related to Obamacare, and so it would be very difficult to create an economic analysis on the legislative pronouncements in the Affordable Care Act at the time it was enacted, and not really understand how it all play out. Here we are almost 18 months later, and they're still enacting regulations that impact the states and local governments. So it would that adds to the timing concerns as well, because of the way the federal government rolls out its legislative pronouncements.
May I follow up, please?
Follow up.
And sometimes there's yet another step in the process too, isn't there? That you really can't tell what the final result will be until a test case is brought and there's a judicial interpretation and maybe even second rounds of legislation and or regulations. So from this legislation here, can you tell, number one, how often you'll have to do one of these reports, and number two, when that will be?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, no, that is a concern of the administration as to if you would have to do multiple economic analyses, or when actually the triggering point is for the analysis, whether it's at the point of legislative enactment or the point of regulatory enactment or at the point of judicial affirmation that the regulation and the law is actually legitimate and constitutional.
Mr. Chair, follow up with the final committee. Final question.
Representative Gruenberg.
How would you implement this bill? Would you be able to implement it, or would it require basically potentially a judicial decision as to when these things are due? How would you know when you have to do it?
Well, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, as it's drafted, it's unclear when those trigger events would happen and whether or not we would have to do multiple impact analysis. The legislation could create that triggering mechanism. It could amend the provisions and say this is when the trigger hits, but it's not in there right now. So at this point, it's unclear as to what the intent would be and whether or not we would have to do multiple or singular economic analyses.
I'm sorry, I do have one more.
One more.
And is it possible to determine what the scope of the, quote, economic effect would be, whether you're asking the federal government to do it or whether the state is doing it? Would you be able, with any degree of certainty, to determine what is meant by the phrase economic effect? The reason I'm concerned is because...
Would you give us the line in the...
The economic effect language is on page 1, line 10.
Thank you.
And that's also referenced on page 2, line 7. It goes back to the earlier phraseology. The reason I'm concerned is because if... there's a group, whether it's an industry group or an environmental group or anybody else, who doesn't like the particular regulation or the effect or whatever, they could tie this whatever it is, the underlying federal legislation and our implementation of it up in litigation, whether it follows the requirement of this or whether there has to be a delay in implementing it until the report is done here, and then it becomes a wheel within a wheel, litigation within litigation. Am I not correct?
Chair Representative Grunberg, again, the legislation as drafted does create that phrase does create some concerns because it doesn't define what that the scope of that report should be or the detail that is required or expected. That could easily be amended by a definitional reference in the legislation that would certainly help the executive branch know exactly what was required, both in terms of, as we spoke earlier, triggering event, and then also what the scope of that report should be.
Thank you. Thank
you. Are you willing, if the sponsor is interested, to work with her to both come up with a trigger point for when the calculation would be made and a definition and scope of report?
Oh, through the chair, absolutely.
Yeah, just wanted to put that on the record. Thanks.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stacy. Is it Craig?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not going to let you just duck, you know. Come on. If you would come up, Craig, in case there's questions. It's a you're the one in OMB that, you know, provided the fiscal note there with a lot of detail, and I'm sure it was in conjunction with the Department of Law, but I just wonder if you had anything to add to what is on the record.
Well, for the record, my name is Craig Coughlin. I'm a policy analyst at OMB. Actually, I don't think I could add anything to that. Previous speaker. I'm available for questions.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you. We're going to set this bill aside, and we'll bring it back at on a future date. Representative.
Yeah, I just want to make one comment here. To begin with, I think it's a great idea, but I guess I wonder whether it goes far enough in that it doesn't include the state. I mean, as a former borough mayor, I know how so often regulations and laws initiated by this state and unfunded mandates that we have put into effect impact communities, individuals, and industries. And while, you know, I agree completely, you know, that the federal government does this to the states and to our communities in the state, I also just want to say for the record that I think that sometimes we're equally guilty of this kind of conduct.
That's in the context of the discussion before us, that's really true. And that I want to say that probably is, well, I know it's in other bills that are pending too, so we'll get to address that. But yeah. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in also the spirit of suggestion to the sponsor of the bill here, because I know that's one of the reasons we're here, to talk about what our things are.
Representative Wilson, come back up and we'll just dialogue and talk about the bill a little bit. And we've got a few minutes to do that, no problem. Go ahead, I'm sorry. Okay. Representative Grunberg.
And I'm not really, Tammy, seeking answers from you, but just kind of issues I spotted. The word community and the word industry on line 11, those are not defined. And community could be everything from an REAA or an unincorporated area to Anchorage. And for a little tiny village out in the middle, as a village community out in the middle of nowhere, it may be beyond them really to see what the effect of something out of Washington, D.C. would be. It may have some practical implications in the bush and in communities. And this isn't the committee that generally looks at things from that point of view. CNRA does look at things, and they're the experts in that. And industry, I talked with Ledge Legal. Industry is not defined. Person is defined, and that's in Title I. I think it's just under the definitions in Title I. But it may not be exactly what you want. And I at one time had Ledge Legal do a legal memo, which I can probably find for you. We may have to find it. Everywhere that person is defined throughout the code, and to see if maybe we should have one better new look at the word person, because we've got LLCs, limited liability corporations, limited liability partnerships, all kinds of things that this committee has recently dealt with or is dealing with in Lindsay Holmes's bill. So those definitions, and I thought maybe that you'd also be interested in the effect on real people, individuals, and I don't know how that would go. But that is one thing that did catch my eye. What I'm kind of saying here is that I think somebody, and your lawyers or somebody, needs to go through and look at almost every word in here to make certain you know what they are and what the implications are. I like the idea, and I also wanted to echo what Representative Ledoux said, because we do the same thing here, and I think maybe there's a lot of merit that this goes should look at too. The other thing here is the very last word in the bill. You have a date certain here, but you don't have an effective date clause, and I don't think you should, because it's going to take a long time to get this thing up and running, and you want to see when it should be effective, and then as a result of that, not just when the bill's effective, but who it applies to. And you should look, I think, at Section C generally, and you might say it takes effect 180 days after the effective date of the bill. Have it tied to the effective date. And those were just a few things I looked at in about a half hour, and I'm happy to help on this. I put my money where my mouth is on all this stuff. But this has got a lot of ramifications, and it should be done right. And if not, then we'll run into the problems that Stacy was talking about, because they won't be able to implement it, or there'll be litigation resulting, and you don't want that.
For the record, my name is Representative Wilson. I would like to just take a minute, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to let law know that I am in room 412 and have been since this has been out there. So, you know, they could have come in and spoken. I have heard from part of them, but this is the first time I met the young lady that was up here beforehand. So just so they know, I do pretty well live there until about midnight every night, so they're more than happy to come there. I will work with you, Representative Grunberg, to make sure we have those parts of it, because I think for me, you know, I know it was taking a big bite to start with. You know what our community is going through with the PM 2.5 issue, and what's really frustrating for my community is that we have EPA put down a mandate on our community with no solutions whatsoever, no modeling that we have yet to see, and millions of dollars that we've tried to do it, yet it affects our military, affects our construction projects. And so every time we see something that comes from the administration that we're going to save the whales, and I love whales, so whale people, please don't write me, and seals and all those others, yet, you know, I have a community that just seems like nobody cares enough to fight back, and that's kind of what stimulated this. And as I started looking at it, I really was appalled to think that we are taking funding just because the funding is there and not realizing. And what Representative Ledoux said, and we actually have looked at Anchorage, because they do look at the regulations to what it does to the city of Anchorage and why we're not doing that. But we've got to talk in one direction, and so I will also work with, you know, Representative Ledoux on seeing if we can't add that portion in there, because if we require the federal government to, you know, that we're wanting them to be accountable, we absolutely need to be accountable too. And if we are not doing an economic analysis, especially now when we know our funds are going low, if the state's funds are going low, we know that the municipalities are going to feel it probably even harder than we are. So I'm not looking for more work. I was really hoping we already did some of this, and really in amazement that so much of what we just automatically think are being done really is not. But I will work with you and on these, and I look forward to that. I appreciate it.
If I may follow up.
Well, we have three waiting online, Representative Grunberg, for public testimony. So I'd like to see if some, you know, just...
Maybe just one more.
If you would, keep it brief.
What I'm going to say is going to sound like a lot more work, but in the end, it'll, I think, pay off. One thing lawyers are good at, hopefully, is spotting issues, is what it's called. And in your when you assemble your group to work on this, I hope you do have law and various people like that who will be able to go through word by word and spot the issues. Then you'll have them, and you won't get something sprung at you on left field. Thank you, Mr.
Does anyone else have any comments?
There's people on the phone.
No, I think it's okay. We started with our dialogue. That was my clumsiness, and I'm sorry, but I think in all fairness, we ought to continue and then let them have the last word today.
I just wanted to say that I thought that Representative Grunberg had made a couple of really good points there, that we might be able to, or you might want to change industry to person, because person generally includes like people like us, but it also includes corporations, and it may, I'm not sure, include LLCs and whatever else that industry.
It hasn't been amended.
Representative Grunberg, did you have a response for Representative Ledoux?
My response is, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Take a look. It's in Title I. You know where it is. And you'll see that hasn't been updated. And, Mr. Chair, maybe during the interim, as we're making lists of things this committee would look at, I would like to see, and it's kind of an informal request because I've been interested in it, we look at whether the definition of person needs to be updated.
That's probably a worthwhile thing to do, yeah. Representative Foster, do you have a comment, or Representative Lynn? No. But I'd like to throw. I really appreciate bringing this forward, and I gotta tell you that in my mind it's a little bit tongue in cheek, and I don't, I don't mean to at all demean the effort, but it is a really fascinating one. This Obamacare, as Obama, by the way, President Obama calls it that himself. I'm not being demeaning here. But it's just huge, you know. And the statement that, well, we've got to pass it before we know what's in it. Well, what's the trigger there to figure out what it's going to cost? You know, that's all still future, you know, so we don't know. But this is a problem. You know, the feds bring a busload of money to town, and then we have to decide, okay, with so many people wanting that busload, you know, just how do we figure it out, what if it's going to cost us? But I really think we need to listen to the public testimony that is called in, and then if there's any other comments, my goal is here no later than, say, 5-2, that we get on to the next bill. So, Mike Coons, are you online?
Yes, sir, I am.
Mike, if you would go ahead and give us your testimony, your brevity would be appreciated, but, so be concise if you would, and we'll go for it.
Up for 3 minutes on this, sir. Chairman Keller and Judiciary Committee members, my name is Mike Coons. I live on Lazy Mountain, and I'm speaking for myself. Although this version of HB 34 is not as strong as the original, I do support the sponsor's intent. From the explanation of changes to CS 34, I quote, House Bill 34 version N required the state to not comply with a federal law, regulation, or executive order unless a report was provided explaining how compliance can be achieved and an economic impact report for each affected community, end quote. This is one of the roles of the state government, to protect our people, jobs, resources, land use, and economic expansion. The original version invoked our 10th Amendment protections against the central government intrusion on our state rights. This CS changes to, before complying with the federal law, the state then requests a description. Then it gives the feds 90 days to comply. The good thing is that it says the State Department responsible may not accept funding until the feds respond with the request. But based on what has been said here with the Department of Law, then if the feds refuse to give any information after the 90 days, then do we nullify that based on House Bill 83? Although the Department of Law will rest easier with this language because we aren't, quote, telling the feds to do something, end quote, I believe the present Congress and President will see this as weakness. Since I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on TV, I have to accept the sponsor's changes based on the Department of Law's advice. However, that does not get over the fact that over the decades our federal government, when given the chance, has overstepped states' rights and to go in so far as to step on the neck of many states, including and specifically ours. No Child Left Behind, Antiquities Act, and the combined Interior Department and EPA shutting down industries such as Tongass Forestry, just to name a few. Even with this kinder version, this bill, along with HB 83, will push back hard to the worst Congress and President in my living history, if not our nation's history, who have shown zero concern for our state and the rights of our state and our people. If you can, reinstate the original version. If not, then pass this bill soonest, along with rapid passage of HB 83 and HB 69, so President Obama and the Congress get the full force of our huge right hook to not only regain our rights, but keep them from eroding those rights any further. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mike. Yes, we have to be alert and figure out the best ways to respond. Wayne, are you there? Wayne Pavelski?
Yes, sir, I'm here, but I just want to apologize. I thought it was going to be the HJR 4. So,
Wayne, if you would, identify yourself for the record and who you represent, and then I understand you may have called in on a different bill, and I'm sorry we've had some changes, but 104 is not before us.
My name is Wayne Rosowski. I'm from Eagle River, and I represent myself.
Yeah, great. So did you have any comments on HB 34 that we have in front of us, or?
No, I'm learning.
Okay, yeah, well, thank you, and I didn't, maybe I didn't to Mike, but I mean, I really appreciate it when you take time to call in, so thank you, Wayne. Charles Edwards.
Yes, I'm concur with what Mike said, and I'm kind of in the boat.
Wait, Charles, if you would, identify yourself first for the record, it's so we get our record straight here.
Charles Edwards from Eagle River. I represent myself, and I wish the whole city of Eagle River, but I believe that if the federal government is trying to give us money or anything to have us, you know, do, I think that we should have the federal government tell us how it's going to impact us, whether I can carry a gun or buy anything, or how it's going to affect me. So I wish that you folks would be able to make the feds tell us what impact whatever they're going to give to us is going to have on us. And I think that you guys should have the responsibility to be able to tell the federal government to go pound sand if it goes against our Constitution. And that's all I have to say.
And it's a valid point. The sponsor provided with her bill, she provided some information on a project called Positive Train Control, and it's unbelievable what the projected cost is turning out to be on that, and yet it's a federal thing that we have to comply with or get an extension on. And those kind of things are just happening regularly. So thank you, Charles. Any last comments before we set the bill aside? Representative Grunberg?
You know, this is a, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of bringing a number of bills back. The circle is coming around. And maybe one thing that will come out of the current discussion, a generalized discussion here and in other states, and in the all the way up to the Supreme Court, is what the role of the states now ought to be. Not just where we are technologically, but where we are politically and philosophically as a nation. And myself, I tend to be not as distrustful of the federal government as some other people. Probably I'm more distrustful than some, but not way out there on this. But I do think that this is an evolving issue, and I'm not sure how we as a nation and as a state should deal with this, but it's something that's worth keeping in mind. It's a common thread that's going through all bunch of bills that we have coming through the legislature this year, this being one of them.
It's it's also a very common thread in our when you go home and knock on doors too and talk to people. But any Representative Lynn?
I'd like to say, well, again, we keep talking about, you know, money from the Fed, federal money, and that sounds good, but I think it's not federal money, it's our money. This money not coming from another planet someplace. Every federal dollar comes from the income tax, the outrageous income tax that we all pay. It's not federal money, it's our money. And it's so easy to forget that.
Okay. I'd like to wrap up, and then we're done with the bill. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. You know, I think we just realize now the more information that we have, the better we are. And we just sometimes kind of fall asleep at the wheel until it starts disturbing us. And I think it just got to that point. I think it hit the people out there pretty hard, all the different things. And we've seen it here as well with the bills that we have seen. And so sometimes we might have to spend some money to find out that information. But I think overall we'll make better choices and maybe choices we should have been making in the first place. We are happy to work with anyone. We'll make sure that as one rolls out before it gets back here, that we have spoken to each one of you to make sure that all the concerns have been answered, as well as the administration. But I just want to put it on record, the administration probably will not be happy with the outcome of the bill, because it will be more work, but it's work that I think that we here are responsible to make sure that we're not putting added pressure on our communities and of the people who live there, and the only ones that can do that is those of us who are here right now. So don't want to make any promises that I can't keep, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. What we'll do now, thank you very much, is go on to House Bill 73, and I'm going to ask my vice chair here to make a motion on a working version, so we all, and I'll make an explanation.
Yes, sir. I would make a motion to adopt the CS for House Bill number 73, Judiciary, /U version, and if somebody would make a objection, so we can discuss the bill.
I'll object, and the reason is I want to explain partly what's going on. This is partly in response to Representative Grunberg's suggestion that we pay attention to what's happened over on the Senate side and not double up our efforts. So what we're doing, this CS version uniform is, it has just been moved, is the Senate version in its current state. So now it's before us as House Bill 73, and we've asked Annie Carpenter from the Department of Law to come, and she's going to give us a section, go through the sectional and tell us where they're at over there. And what I'm, the goal is, again, to we're not going to act on the bill today, so we're going to document, you know, anything that we see now, and I realize there may be things that we see later, but try to get the information to my office so that we get as far ahead for the Monday meeting as we can, so we can potentially act on it. Representative Grunberg, do you have a question?
I just wanted to thank you, because among other things, taking the work they've done now gives us something, if we're looking at amendments, where to put them in this bill so it melted in seamlessly. And I'm working on at least one amendment that I've discussed with you. And I appreciate you doing this.
Oh, yeah, thank you. You know, I think sometimes we forget what it costs us, what it costs the state for us to do a piece of legislation. I've seen some numbers on it. So anything we can do to be efficient, not duplicate, is good. Representative Lebeau.
Are we on you?
Yes, Bernard.
All right.
Well, I'll remove my objection if there's no other comments on this version. Okay, I'll remove my objection. Yes, now we're on you, seeing
okay.
Your objection.
Thank you.
Did you want to ask the question before we... that was your question?
That was my question. I just wanted to make sure that we were literally on the same page.
Yes. Okay. What I'm going to do is ask Annie to go over this, and we can, you know, if time allows us here, we can ask questions as we go, try to be efficient with our time.
I think, shut up. I'm interested in having Annie get us.
One thing, when you get to Section 39, Quinlan Steiner from the Public Defender's Office has asked to have a comment, and if it's okay, I'd like to interrupt you at that point, and you know, when you're on Section 39, so you can have the option of responding.
Sure.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Gruber. It would help me also, because I have not studied the difference between the two versions, and I think we had started at least to go through the earlier version. It may help if Ms. Carpinetti can, if there's a real difference between the two versions, flag that for us so we can see what the Senate has done to make the changes, and that way we're on board.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I had prepared just to go and discuss the differences, but I'm happy to go on a section-by-section basis. Now, I was going to discuss...
No, proceed the way you planned is fine with me, unless there's any objection here. Yeah, if you would, the differences.
Because I understand that you went through HB 73
yes.
section-by-section before.
That's exactly okay. Right, yeah.
Okay. Well, the first... let's see. Make sure I'm on the same page. The first change that the Senate made appears on page 6 of the bill, on lines 5 through 9. And the Senate adopted an affirmative defense to the crimes of engaging in sexual penetration or sexual contact by a probation or a parole officer with a person on probation or parole. And they adopted this affirmative defense to the new crimes that the offender and the person on probation or parole had before the person was placed on probation or parole, a pre-existing dating or sexual relationship which continued on to the date of the alleged offense. So that is new in this provision, in this bill. Next.
May I ask, I'm sorry. I said I'd shut up, but I won't.
Yeah, Representative Gruber.
So this section was added?
Yes.
Was there any objection from the witnesses or any problem with that?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, no. Not that I recall. I think that was pretty well accepted okay. as an idea that should...
I'm sort of setting a procedure.
Mm-hmm.
That not only do we get the site and what was done, but whether it's new or a change, and if there was any, if there was controversial or not. I didn't think this
okay.
was.
Okay. No, there was not. There was no controversy about this addition.
Before you proceed, and I also have not gone through and identified the change differences, but my staff says asked me if on page 5, section 7, if that isn't also new. Down at the bottom of page 5.
Oh, actually, you know, that is new. It's current law, and it's a marriage defense to this conduct of a probation officer or parole officer, and it already exists in current law, but we just added a sexual assault in the fourth degree so that the marriage defense applies to a probation officer who has sexual relations with his or her wife, that would not be a crime. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that.
That just shows you what a smart staff I have.
You do. It sure does.
Representative.
And, you
know. Representative.
So, as this bill now reads, if somebody is on probation or parole in Anchorage, for example, or in Bethel, or any other place around the state, mm-hmm. and they meet somebody who happens to be a parole or correctional officer in a totally different area of the state, they can't go out, so to speak.
Through the chair, that's correct. I mean, if, in order for the crime to apply, the probation or parole officer has to know or act with reckless disregard that the person was on probation or parole.
You know, I guess I always thought that it would just apply to somebody, and I mean, this doesn't matter what the age is of the person who's on probation or parole.
Through the chair, there's a portion of it that applies to adults, and there's a portion that applies to minors, and that only applies to 18 and 19-year-old minors.
And somehow or other, I guess I had thought that this applied to a probation officer engaging in a relationship with somebody who was under his or her direct control, as opposed to a probation officer who has nothing to do with an individual and, you know, ends up in a relationship. I mean, I guess I don't think that's all that awful if they're not under their direct control. I mean, if you're talking about somebody who may be on probation or parole in Nome, and they meet somebody who is in a totally different community, and they're not underneath. That's not a good thing to say right now. if
your point's well taken.
Not going to stick your tongue either.
Anyway, I think everybody knows what I'm trying to get at right now.
Yep. And Representative Grunberg and then Representative Levin.
No, I think that's a good. I hope you pursued thinking on that.
Did you want to respond first, Amy? I'm sorry.
Sure. I'll be happy to respond to that. It's been and raised before. But the thinking is, and the conclusion that we came to, and we thought about that concern, is that a probation or parole officer, even though he or she doesn't have direct control over a person on probation or parole, he or she does have control over that person, is in a position of authority, because in the next desk or in the next, and it's a statewide system of probation or parole, they do have authority over that person. And whether or not it's direct or not, it still is a position of authority.
Okay. We had got a list here going, 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
No. Okay, Representative Lynn.
I'm just looking at the practical aspects of this thing. Somebody's on probation or parole, and they're going to another part of the state, and some probation or parole officer ask somebody out for a date. First, do you say, before I ask you out for a date, are you on probation or parole? That could spoil a lot of relationships.
Well, if you ask that question, we don't want to spoil relations. However,
I wouldn't get many dates like that. it's a practical. You know, how do you? That's not the first thing you would ask, I wouldn't think.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, the crime doesn't even apply unless the probation officer knows that the person is on probation or parole or is reckless in connection with that.
And it says that here?
Yeah.
Yes.
The knowing. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if a person knows that they're on probation, then they shouldn't pursue any kind of relationship. But say they've already pursued the relationship, they've had a sexual contact, and then 24 hours later they find out that they are on probation, at that point it's okay then, because they didn't knowingly do it? Is that correct?
I suppose through the chair it would depend on the facts. Certainly the original sexual encounter, if there's no knowledge that the person is on probation or parole, would not be in violation of the law. Pursuit of that, since it was pre-existing, I think it would be something that I'd have to think about and get back to you.
Representative Lynn, I think, was first. If it's okay, and then Lynn.
Well, you could say, you know, they have this relationship, and the probation officer doesn't know, then the relationship goes sour, and then the parolee says, I told him, did it anyway.
Through the chair, you know, these things happen in human relationships.
Well, that's right, and that's why this is a dangerous section, because these things, you know, do happen, and somebody could be in deep chemistry for it.
Through the chair, you know, we have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person before it happened knew or was reckless in regard to whether or not the person was on probation.
I'll be careful next time.
I guess I'm a little bit concerned. I see that the person has to either know or engages in sexual contact with a person with reckless disregard. So I'm going to go back to Representative Lim's first question. Is it reckless disregard if the probation or parole officer meets somebody and fails to ask that question, are you on probation or patrol or parole? And, I mean, you know, that might be something which would be a deal breaker in, in any sort of, you know, I mean, it's not generally one of the first things that people might ask.
Well,
through the chair, could I just explain what reckless disregard? Reckless disregard is defined in our statute is with respect to a circumstance, which this would be a person on probation or parole. The person is aware of and consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the circumstance exists. The risk must be of such a nature and degree that disregard of it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of conduct that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. So it's not just you meet somebody and you like them and you get together. The person has to have be aware of and consciously disregard a risk that the person is on probation or parole. It's not just I'm sorry to hear you were, you know, they didn't know it and they didn't ask. That wouldn't apply.
It's a criminal law warp definition that has caused more more confusion. The word reckless, so you're absolutely right. You know, that's very significant. And I would ask that as the committee considers any potential amendments to this section to review that definition of reckless. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So did this come up because there has been a problem in the past?
Through the chair, yes, and it just came up this last summer. It came up for the first time since the criminal code was enacted, as far as I know, for the first time, and that was a probation officer working in the therapeutic court in Anchorage who was engaging in sexual conduct with people under his control, and they were bargaining, and the court found that that did not include that. That was not covered by our sexual assault statutes.
Thank you.
Okay. On page 6, lines 10 through 22, there was some redrafting in this section, and for clarification, this was not at all controversial. It just made it clear that if a person was ordered by a court not to contact a victim or witness and
Where's
was...
There, aren't we?
Pardon? We're on page 6. Lines 10 through 22.
Okay, please continue.
Yeah, we're talking about unlawful contact with a victim or witness. There have been situations in, particularly in Fairbanks, where a defendant as a condition who's been charged with a crime is ordered by the judge not to contact a victim or witness, and because he or she is unable to be bailed out or to meet the condition of bail, they still call the victim or witness dozens of times, and the court found that since they weren't actually on bail, that the crime did not apply to them. So this makes it clear that if they're ordered by a court not to contact a victim or witness, they have to abide by that order, even if they're still in jail. Sections, page 6, lines 27 through 29, this is the forfeiture provision that was discussed in this committee before. It was amended in the Senate Judiciary Committee to apply equally to a prostitute and a patron of a prostitute, but it was also amended so that it would only apply at sentencing, so that the property of could not be forfeited unless the person was actually convicted, and it was rewritten to provide that it's at the discretion of the judge, not mandatory.
What line?
Good clarification.
Excuse me.
That's page 6, line 29.
Lines 27 through 29.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
It's a little better than it was because the word shall on line 29 has been changed to may on line 28. But I'm just serving notice that I may very well offer an amendment either to delete that or significantly narrow it because it's such a draconian remedy in many cases.
It may be appropriate in some, but I want to be very careful before we take people's family cars and homes or whatever. That's just really tough.
Did you want to say something in our contemplation of that possible pending amendment that would prepare help us to think about this?
Well, you know, it's not an uncommon provision in law to allow property to be forfeited. To tell you the truth, I don't think we've ever asked for forfeit. Well, that's not correct. I think there are some cases where the municipality of Anchorage has asked asked to forfeit property, but I'm not familiar enough to describe it to you.
Mr. Representative Ledoux has a question, I believe.
Yeah, so under this new forfeiting it at sentencing, does that mean you can sell it before you're sentenced?
I'm sorry, you can sell it?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, if you're if you've just been tried and you've been convicted and you're looking at forfeiture, I mean, it might not be a bad idea to sell the property.
I think it depends on the facts of the case. If you sold it, maybe the assets that you got from it would be forfeited, but it's not
that
clear here.
I don't think that says that here, so.
Well, it says property used to institute, aid, or facilitate. But I could get back to you. I mean, this would require some research into general forfeiture law, and I will happy to get back to you on that one.
Thank you.
So we can expect a discussion on that. Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, just for the record, the amendment, the other amendment I've talked to you about, we've just gotten, and I'll give it to Ernest, so since it's got several documents with it, it'll be passed out to the members and they can look at it over the weekend. I'm not going to do anything with it.
Yeah, okay. If we have time, I'll have you describe what it does. And
I'm just giving it to you guys to look at over the
right,
weekend.
Right. Yeah. But I would rather you explain a little bit what it is because it's the same subject issue or title issue that might be a difference. And I think that's going to take a little more thought.
But I did want to say one thing on this. The forfeiture provisions that I've seen have more been title the gambling. They're gambling forfeitures. And I'm not sure if this is in Title 11 or is the gambling statutes, are that Title 4?
Through the chair, the criminal provisions addressing gambling are in Title 11.
Okay, well, it's in one of them. Is that where the forfeiture provisions are? Are they in Title 11 for gambling?
I'd have to check on that.
There are a whole lot of not recent cases, I don't think. I haven't looked recently. Mm. But there are cases from like the 1960s. And you'll see the name of the case is like three pair of dice and $2,500 versus the state. They're kind of unusually captioned cases. And they have used them in gambling stuff. Mm-hmm. I remember Sandy Seville took one of them.
One of the more colorful cases. They are colorful.
They really are.
The titles of the forfeiture
I don't recall
cases.
Any in this kind of a circumstance. I don't recall any sex crimes.
For the state, no, I don't think so. I think the municipality may have pursued forfeiture, but I'm not aware of any for the state at this point, but I'll be happy to double check on that.
Please proceed.
The next change is I think maybe I'll just describe at page 8. And in terms of GPS monitoring, the Senate Judiciary Committee made a decision not to include any possibility of GPS tracking of individuals in connection with a civil protective order. It decided it would be best at this point to pursue that in connection with a criminal charge where the defendant has appeared in front of the judge and made it a discretionary condition of bail release. Currently it provides that the Department of Corrections will adopt regulations, or not regulations, but will adopt guidelines working with the Department of Public Safety for the type of monitoring program that might be possible. The Senate at some point was thinking about requiring it to be an active tracking system and then decided to wait and see what guidelines were were determined by Department of Public Safety and Department of Corrections. So the civil protect, provisions are out and are don't even appear in this bill. But
okay.
The next change appears on page 9. This is the change in the Rape Shield law that protects a complaining witness in sexual assault, sexual abuse, or unlawful exploitation of minor from it protects against invasion of their privacy in terms of prior sexual conduct. This expands it to after the alleged offense sexual conduct. And what it does, the Rape Shield law requires a defendant who wants to introduce this evidence to apply to the judge and have a hearing in camera so that the situation, the questions can be raised in a more private setting. And the bill would also require the defendant to ask permission or ask for permission to use this evidence 5 days before trial. The Senate Judiciary Committee added that they could ask afterwards for good cause, or if the information was discovered after the deadline, that they could ask permission to raise the issue to the judge and have it determined.
Okay.
So that was a change made in Senate Judiciary.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
When we discuss this, or now if you wish, Ms. Carpinetti, what was the need on line 23 for the phrase "for good cause"? That seems to set a higher standard than the normal court discretion, because obviously a court wouldn't admit the evidence unless there was cause. And I'm wondering whether the Senate or yourself feels that there should be even higher standard than that.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the concern was that if a defense attorney did not raise the issue within the 5 days before trial, if there was good reason to do that, he or she could raise it at a later time. And the concern was that you wouldn't want to have a defendant suffer if the defense attorney for some reason forgot to ask or just didn't.
Through the chair, I'm thinking of the opposite,
mm-hmm.
because it would seem to me that the court wouldn't grant the motion unless there were cause for waiving or relaxing the rule, mm-hmm. but I don't know. Is it?
I think it was just a concern about being extra cautious. It wasn't something that we suggested. It was something suggested by the defense bar and
I see, and they like the language "for good cause."
Yes.
Oh, that's fine. Okay, thank you.
On page 10, after between lines 2 and 3, I just note that the Senate Judiciary Committee completely removed all the provisions addressing immunity and how we litigate questions of Fifth Amendment privilege and when we should be conferring immunity. So that those are completely out, and as are the rules that address that. So you won't see those in this version. Section 17.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Just for the record, would you explain why they removed it?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the chair of the Senate Judiciary explained to me that he was concerned that it, for some reason, might be abused and was uncomfortable with having it in there. We would rather see it in, but we understand his concerns.
I just wanted that on the record because I could see that why they were, but I wanted you to put it on the record.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Section 17, this is the provision that requires a defendant who participates in treatment as a condition of bail to, it requires them to request credit for that treatment at sentencing and make notice of it 10 days before the sentencing proceeding. The Senate Judiciary Committee changed it so that the person has 90 days after the sentencing proceeding to make the claim or otherwise for good cause. Section page 10, lines 14 to 21 were added in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and this addresses people who participate in treatment while their conviction is being appealed, and it requires them to bring the request for credit for time spent in treatment pending appeal within 90 days after the case is returned from the appellate court to the sentencing court, or for good cause. Section 18.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I can see the filing of the notice and bringing it to the attention of the trial court during the pendency of the appeal, or after the appeal. If an appeal often will take a year or more, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There may be substantial time invested in the treatment program without knowing whether this is likely to be approved. Would the defendant be able to get an advance permission, at least a tentative permission, so they didn't go through a whole huge and expensive treatment program? And I've seen personally how difficult these things are and expensive they are for the family. Would there be any way of getting a tentative approval or something without having to do it and then try to get permission?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think that a person under this circumstance would have to get the trial judge's permission to participate in this. So it's something that I don't think is a crapshoot in that sense. But you know, there's statutory provisions for credit for treatment programs, and I believe that the trial court judge reviews those, and I will double check that.
Please,
to make sure I'm correct.
I'd like to be sure there's a provision that normally you would do it, but if, like, you might have a young person who doesn't know all the ins and outs of the whole thing and might do it, and then they could seek permission afterwards. But, you know, I think the goal of treatment is something we need to foster here.
Through the chair, if it makes you feel any better, subsection L that we're just talking about now was suggested by the Public Defender Agency. So
okay.
That might
if
help.
If you could look, you know, anything you do. Thank you.
And Section 18 also is a provision that requires a defendant who participates in treatment as a condition of bail in connection with a motion to revoke probation should, within 10 days of the disposition hearing, make a request for credit for the treatment. The Senate Judiciary also added a 90-day grace period after the disposition hearing, and also a good cause provision. Next changes appear on page 11 and 12, and these are the ones that deal with the Collins decision and the changes that the Court of Appeals made in the standards for reference to a three-judge panel. And we worked on these sections with the Public Defender Agency. It was taken out the provision that it was a youthful offender, and an addition of the word at the suggestion of the public defender on line 28, that the referral is based solely on the claim that the defendant, either singly or in combination, has prospects that are less than extraordinary or a history free of unprosecuted, undocumented, or undetected sexual offenses. And I think that the cooperative work, and also the I know there was concern with the way it was drafted in the original version, and Legislative Affairs, I think, did a great job of turning it around so it's not a couple of double negatives. So I think it makes it clearer for everybody to understand. And those changes appear both in Section 21 and 22. And I think what we get is a more direct addressing more directly the decision in the Collins versus State decision. Let's see. The next change appears on page 13, starting at line 27. And I guess the most the easiest way to explain it is Section 25 right now I consider to be a conforming amendment. Our statutes for civil protective orders require that protective orders say on the face of the order, and these words are in statute, that violation of certain provisions of a civil protective order for domestic violence, stalking, and sexual assault may be a misdemeanor. And it provides that the penalty for the maximum penalty for a misdemeanor is 1 year of incarceration, and the legislature has increased the fine, the maximum fine for a Class A misdemeanor is no longer $5,000, it's $10,000. So it makes that change in Section 25, and then 26, the Senate Judiciary Committee made that conforming change in another section. Section 27 is the provision that extends the evidentiary privilege between a counselor and a person who's a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault. Right now there's an evidentiary privilege for confidential communications between the counselor and a victim. This extends that evidentiary privilege to counselors who operate on United States military bases or who are contracted for by United States military. By the United States, a branch of the United States military. Before the change, it was a little. It just said military organizations, which people thought was a little bit too broad. So this tightens it down a little bit.
Representative Grunberg,
would this cover all types of victim counseling centers? For example, the Native Medical Center and things like that. I think should be as broad as possible to cover all legitimate victim counseling centers.
I believe it does. It means as you can see, it defines victim counseling center means a private organization. Now that it with the change, it would include United States military organizations or a local government agency that provides these services. So I think it would.
My question, and Mr. Chair, this is just something I'd like the Department of Law to get your legal research on a little bit.
Okay. And you said it was the Native Justice?
Well, like the Native Medical Center. I don't know how that's set up particularly, but I want to be sure that we haven't had the unintended consequence of eliminating a certain class of legitimate counseling centers.
Uh-huh. Okay, I will double-check that, but I think that Native Medical Center would be considered a private organization, but I will certainly double-check.
It may well be. Mm-hmm. My comment is just a general one, because I know Murphy's Law operates well in these circumstances. You just don't technically catch somebody, and then they have no privilege.
Representative Ledoux.
So what about a counseling center operated by a tribal government or a village? I'm just trying to think that are there areas in the bush, you might be able to help me here, which don't, I know there are, they don't have city governments, and we're not talking about, you know, Indian lands or tribal law, we're talking about places like Iliamna, for example. I don't think Iliamna, that I used to represent, has a city government. Instead, it has its local native association, and I guess I'm not sure that would fall under this.
Annie?
Well, through the chair, I think we would probably want it to, and we should look into it. I would assume that it's a private organization, but or a local government agency. It's one or the other, but maybe we ought to be specific.
Well, it acts like a local government organization, but it actually isn't an official government organization. But it's not a private organization, really. It's just sort of something.
Through the chair, I'll be happy to look into that and maybe suggest some changes that would cover that, too.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on that, I believe and I assume, but would just want verification that village health clinics, you know, would fall under that just because they're branches of, say, Mountain Wales. You've got, you know, work under the Norton Sound Health Corporation. Mm-hmm. But again, just would want to make sure. But two things that I can think of that I think you've brought up there are good points are you look at Metlakatla and Venati, and they have either a reservation status or something similar too, and therefore with those, you know, we just want to make sure that they're inclusive mm-hmm. of that. So.
Okay. I'll look into it and get be prepared for next week. Let's see. On page 15, this is the provision concerning the Judicial Council gathering information at the time of judicial retention election to include information about whether the judge pays attention to the law in terms of victims, the impact of on victims of crimes that were committed. There's some wordsmithing here that we did in with the court system. It no longer refers to a statute, it just refers to the judge's consideration of victims.
So you're on lines 20 to 22 there?
Yes, I'm on page 15, lines 20 to 22.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
What they did was they just changed this, or is this a whole new section?
No, they just did, we did some wordsmithing that, on it at the suggestion of the court system who is working with the Judicial Council. The next change would appears on page 17, and this is in connection with the provisions in the law that make just expand the attorney the or address the ability of the Attorney General to issue administrative subpoenas for identifying information in connection with an investigation of child pornography cases. And it right now the law allows only the Attorney General himself to issue these administrative subpoenas. And the bill was changed in Senate Judiciary so that, actually the original bill said, or his designee who must be a lawyer in the department. This, the Senate Judiciary Committee changed it to require that the designee must be either the head of the civil division or the head of the criminal division. So we've got a lawyer who's obviously has a lot of experience and good judgment and in making decisions on whether or not to approve these administrative subpoenas. And that was a concern that the Senate Judiciary Committee had.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Before we mark this bill up and send it out, I would like the Department of Law to look at this very carefully because it may very well be that the Attorney General and his office might prefer the previous version, because it may very well be that both the deputy AGs might be out of the state or otherwise occupied, and you need to get a subpoena or is it a search warrant they're looking at here?
It's a subpoena to get evidence from an internet service provider.
Okay, they may need to do that quickly. Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me that you should have, if the question is that you need to have somebody who has sufficient authority and experience, we can say that a little more generically, that gives you, the department, the authority to act quickly.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that was the purpose of the amendment of the provision in this bill, to at least expand to another individual the authority to grant these to issue these administrative subpoenas. I'll tell you that the Senate Judiciary Committee had some concerns about it being a person, in a lawyer in our department, who has sufficient experience and judgment and history to that they would allow that.
I understand, but there are a lot of very experienced lawyers over there. I don't want to tie the AG's hand, because if in fact there is ongoing discovery or litigation, that may tie these two individuals to Juneau or wherever this is, and not be able to do their normal duties. Mm-hmm. I want to be sure you have the flexibility you need to operate.
Thank you.
So I've got all three originals.
Let's see. In terms of mandatory reporting by volunteer coaches, the Senate Judiciary Committee added a section on page 19, section 37, lines 22 through 31, to limit the volunteer coach's duty to be a mandatory reporter to these circumstances. One, that the volunteer spends at least 4 hours a week for four consecutive weeks or 20 hours in 1 month period. Has received the training required by statute under Title 47 for school districts, has received similar training, and three, has signed a form acknowledging that the coach is required to report abuse or neglect under this section.
I know we have a representative due, and I also want to point out that Representative Pruitt also has a concern on this. In fact, has I think probably both of you have talked to me about an amendment here, so we'll see more of this.
Yeah,
Representative
Ledoux. I just wanted to put on the record that this still is not satisfactory to me, and that if this is not out of this for the unpaid volunteers, then I'm probably going to end up voting against the bill. I mean, I feel very, very strongly that volunteers should not be included in this.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, at one point in the Senate Judiciary, it was taken out, and then there was a compromise that put this information back in. So you're not alone in terms of your feeling.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Groomberg?
I echo the
concern. I don't think a section has a chance in this committee. But let's go ahead.
Section 37 or a section?
Yeah.
Well, I will say that there are members of the Senate who feel very strongly on the other side that everybody should have a duty to report. So that's the dilemma.
That's the balancer.
Yeah.
We will anticipate that one.
Let's see. Section 39 was the one that Mr. Steiner wanted to comment on, and I will, if you wanted to do that.
Sure. Quinlan, are you online waiting patiently?
Let me ask one question first.
Representative Groomberg wants to ask a question
first. Which section is he talking about?
39, yes, page 20.
That I went on 38. Was 38 unchanged?
Yes, 38 is unchanged. But you could approach this amendment or the compromise in different ways. But the way that the Judiciary Committee in the Senate decided to do it was add the section 37 and not change the definition.
Okay. So, Quinlan, identify yourself for the record and give us your comments on 39.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. I wanted to comment on section 39 as to what I think is likely to turn out to be some unintended consequences of this section. Section 39 is a direct court rule amendment to Criminal Rule 16, which is the rule governing discovery to defense counsel, Section B in particular. And what this section does is restricts copying of child pornography to defense counsel, except under certain circumstances, which generally I don't have any concern about. That is typically what we do now is, we don't take possession of this material, but go look at it. There are instances, however, this material needs to be transferred to experts for analysis. And what this section does is limits the transfer to out-of-state experts only. If it's an in-state expert, that in-state expert would be required to go to the location where the material is stored, either a law enforcement facility or a prosecution facility. Ultimately, the cost of requiring an expert to move their essentially all of their equipment for analysis, they'd be required to set up an office in another location, which would make it impracticable for them to schedule to do this type of analysis and would drive the cost up. And here's the unintended consequence. That's likely to force defense agencies to seek outside experts rather than in-state experts, thus exposing this material to more copying and possibly incidental loss and distribution. It would also open it up to possibly a constitutional attack if we were unable to engage more credible experts simply because they were unable to schedule the time it would take to move all their electronic and whatever materials they needed to do the analysis. And so I think that would, in a way, frustrate the original intent of keeping this contained in the state and subject to less copying.
See no questions? Sandy, do you have a comment or a question? Or?
Mr. Chairman, this provision has been considered in the past. We put the provision about sending it to expert witnesses outside the state at the request of the public defender. We're really trying to limit how many times we have to copy this material, because every time you do it, you victimize the child yet again. And that's why we were trying to keep it as tight as possible. But, you know.
Okay. We will consider that. Representative LeDuc?
I think he's got a point. That it doesn't make it. I mean, for example, if I want to make sure I understand what Quentin is saying and then get your response to it, but like if the file is in Nome, for example, which probably doesn't have too many expert witnesses, and the expert is in Anchorage, would that mean that if you get an Anchorage expert, he's got to fly up to Nome in order to look at this stuff, but if you got an expert from Seattle, you could ship it to Seattle? I mean, that doesn't really make a lot of sense to me.
That's his point.
Quinlan, did you bring this up to on the Senate side, or is this the first time you've expressed this?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, I have expressed this before, but in the context of the entire bill, and nobody's really fully responded on the committee to this concern. And I think that example is certainly possible. This will drive this expert usage to out of state. What's crafted here, you know, without the out-of-state expert limitation, is sort of typically how it works now. When we need to transfer this type of material to an expert, it's done under a stipulation and court order, even in-state experts. You know, that governs how it's transferred and how it's returned or how it's destroyed. It's a process that we use now, and both the prosecution and the defense are comfortable with. I think this is an unintended consequence will be that it'll force all of this material out of state due to cost.
On Monday, we're going to take up the bill again, if possible, and planning on it. And at the time, we'll be considering specific amendments. And I think I just heard Representative LeDoux say she's going to be working on this one. Representative Grunberg.
Good. Well, yeah, if you'll
Let's
do
work
that.
On it to get.
Oh, I'm happy to. I think what we need, Quinlan and Gabrielle, is just a proposed yesable amendment, yesable proposition.
And please get that copy of that to Annie Carpinetti so that, you know, just for efficiency to make sure we understand the ramifications always. So before we go on, I think you wanted to say something on 38, and I cut you off. Back on Section 38.
Yeah. I just wanted to say that I am so uncomfortable with 38 as it now stands. I mean, I just really think that making volunteers subject to this is just an awful, awful idea. I really worry, and I don't know what we could do about this, that if this bill, you know, goes out of committee, you know, and we make the change to it, and then there's the Senate there who wants it the way it is. At the end of the day, you know, we're going to have the Senate version.
I think that remains to the chair. That's a long
Representative
way
Grunberg.
Of ways of dealing with it.
Yeah, man, I appreciate the alert and the concern. You can proceed.
I would say that the Senate version is a lot farther along than the House version. But
is it one?
I think it's probably a lot farther along. Oh. It's already in Senate Finance.
No, but what I mean is, okay, so it goes through this committee, and it gets stripped out, and then we vote on our bill, and I'm just afraid of what happens at the end of the day.
Don't worry. It'll be dealt with.
And that is a description of the changes that were made between 73 and the version that you're considering now.
I'm impressed. I was flying blind. I didn't know if we'd end up at a quarter after three, a quarter to 3. Representative Grunberg.
Two things. There's a judiciary, another criminal bill, a judiciary bill that deals with the McKinley case and some of the other stuff. And your staff and you and I have talked about that. I'm going to be looking at that and seeing if there's anything in there that should go in here. Because we're so far along, there aren't going to be zillions of bills floating around. We need to find anything that is a train if we think things should be in. And the other thing is this amendment here that I've given out to everybody. It's a little bit different. There's a statute that is described in the memorandum from Ledge Legal here, and then there's a research paper that goes with it. Right now, the law is a little bit unclear, but in 25 words or less, as a result of legislation that passed in 1987, an independent action can be filed against a person who has sexually assaulted another person or incestually assaulted another person to terminate the parental rights. And this was as a result of a particular case that's discussed in the memorandum. The curative legislation had to be rushed through. And I was on this committee at the time and was involved with this. And because of the time-sensitive nature, that bill had to be passed before a remand trial occurred as a result of a Supreme Court opinion. And they wanted to just cover the situation in that case and not really go into other issues. So there's a statute here, and it's in the amendment on lines 8 to 12. And what this is a savings statute. And it says just because you terminate somebody's right to the parental right to the child because they've incestually impregnated this person, that doesn't eliminate the person or the child's right to any other equitable relief and injunction against this person or legal relief for damages. But what the language says is that if it's sexual abuse of a minor or incest, and the victim may have been the adult. And so this will allow and save the result so that the adult could get the injunctive relief or the legal relief too. There's also another statute called the Tort Claims Act that they could proceed under, but this is slightly confusing. And what we're doing here, hopefully, if the committee adopts this, is allow a victim, whether the victim is the parent seeking the injunction or the child, to get the injunction or go after the person for damages. And hopefully it'll be agreeable. Something that's bothered me for a while. As you'll see in the memo, I asked Myra Munson, the commissioner at the time, why they limited it to minor, and she said, because we want to get this thing going so we can get this in place when they have the remand trial.
Okay, we'll read the memo, and if you would, the Department of Law, review it, and we will take that under consideration. So, any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for bringing your attention. I appreciate it.
Okay. So I think we got all the housekeeping done, and we all know what's ahead of us. So we're going to gavel out at 10 minutes 3.